On ABC Radio National, this is Big Ideas. Hello, I'm Alan Saunders. Usually you can hear me on By Design or the Philosopher's Zone, but today I'm here to introduce a lecture by the world-renowned philosopher and author John Ralston Saul. Ralston Saul is a celebrated Canadian novelist and essayist who has been awarded, amongst other honours, Chile's Pablo Neruda Medal, Italy's Premio Literario Internazionale, and the Chevalier des Arts et des Lettres de France. He's the author of Voltaire's Bastards, The Doubter's Companion, The Unconscious Civilization, and most recently, The Collapse of Globalism and the Reinvention of the World. He argues that the modernity of the West, the rational modernity of the Enlightenment, of the Industrial Revolution, is so old-fashioned, it's so old hat that it's had its day, and yet it pretends to be modern. From the Sydney Town Hall with the Collapse of Globalism, John Ralston Saul.
Well, good evening. Saturday, I arrived, and on the Sunday, I went straight up to the Blue Mountains and stayed in a, you know, not a very difficult place to stay, a big, nice hotel, and walked out the next day along Great Chasm there and went to Echo Point, which, of course, is a very touristy spot, very, very beautiful touristy spot, in a way almost like an equivalent of Niagara Falls in Canada. It was a nice day. It hadn't started raining. And all over the grass, there were new Australians, what I would call, what we call new Canadians, new Australians, immigrants who'd become citizens. And they were picnicking in families all over the grass there. And you could smell all the different smells of all the different cuisines from around the world that they were bringing. And because I've seen this so often before in Canada, I immediately got the sense of it. What they were really doing was they were saying, well, here we are, we're Australian. You know, we're Australian in all the complexity and wonder of this place, and we're trying to figure out how to be Australian in our own way, and yet in the Australian way. And one of the things to do is to go out in public and picnic and be seen to be Australian in a quintessentially Australian place. It's a statement of belonging, of being, to do that in public, in that way, in your own way. I find it, frankly, extremely moving when I see that. I think how sad it is that there are so many countries that belong to this theoretically the same civilization we belong to, which is to say the European Western civilization, that there are so many countries that don't understand how fabulous that is, how moving that is, how beautiful that is, how courageous that is, people who've chosen to come to a new country and to become part of that country, not to simply melt into it, but to consciously, in public, find ways of belonging and of being Australian or Canadian. And whenever I see that in a place like that, I think to myself, what an astonishing opportunity this is for, in this case, Australia, to act differently from the other countries in the Westphalian, monolithic, Western, democratic tradition, to actually act with the complexity and originality that comes out of this kind of statement, this kind of intelligence of being open to complexity of people from all over the world and figuring out how all of those people are going to become part of, without simply in that old 18th, 17th, 18th, 19th, even 20th century European way of simply disappearing into the oneness of the place, but actually adding to the complexity and richness of the place. So I think there's an astonishing opportunity to, in fact, not reinforce the tired and failed Western models of the monolithic nation state, but in fact to be more and more original in inventing, reinventing, enriching the complexity of the non-monolithic, different style nation-state. I say this with, I think, some confidence because I've been here enough and I know that, you know, in your history you got some things wrong, in our history we got some things wrong, we're still getting some things wrong, but that essentially you're on the right road and we're more or less on the right road, and it's a different road and it's an interesting road. So you're thinking to yourself, what the hell is he talking about? He's supposed to be talking about globalism. Well, I am. I'm talking about something really interesting, about internationalism, which is to say the possibility that people could consciously, because of course an immigrant is conscious, right? More conscious than those of us who are born in a place. We don't have to be conscious. We're just born here. We can get through life half asleep and still say we're Canadian or Australian. But if you decide to come to a place, you're conscious and you're courageous. You've already proved that by crossing from one place to another, no matter how poor you are or how in danger. So there's an astonishing new kind of both positive nationalism, sense of belonging and of community, end of internationalism, none of which has very much to do with the old style patriotism, the old style stuff, you know, brought from England, brought from France, brought from Germany, brought from Italy, stuff which didn't work, which failed miserably. And I mean, sure, they're interesting countries, you know. But many of us came from those countries. And, you know, let's not forget that the country that I came from is just coming out of, yet again, out of a civil war in Northern Ireland, where I think 3,000 Britons have been killed by Britons within our lifetime. I mean, if there's students in this audience, within your lifetime, 3,000 Britons killed by Britons in your lifetime. That's called a civil war, right? And, you know, between 1914 and 1945, the Westphalian, I don't know if you know that term. It's one of those really boring, I think it's 16, does somebody know the date? 1648 or something like that. And it's a treaty which really creates the beginning of the idea of the monolithic nation state, which will lead to, between 1914 and 1945, the murder of about 100 million Europeans by other Europeans in a desperate attempt to create pure, beautiful little nation states in which there's only one race, one language, one mythology, one religion. Perfect little pink people or white people or whatever, praying the same prayers and reading the same books. Complete purity, so natural, they only had to kill 100 million people in less than half a century. And that was only the latest attempt, right? This is not a success story. It's a great story for, you know, production, and it's a great story in some ways for democracy, but it's not a great story for human relationships. Even if at the end of the day we've come out of it, if we belong to it, okay. The road was extremely expensive. And so if, you know, what I'm sort of saying here is that there's an interesting opportunity if you're Australian or Canadian, because we know what that tradition is, but we also belong to another tradition, one which was here before any immigrants came, and is still here and still very much alive and has many philosophical bases to it, and one which has been created much more thanks to what is here than is admitted by most of the immigrants, an approach which is not monolithic, which is not singular, which is not Westphalian, which doesn't have one language, which has multiple myths. And if those of us who are immigrants are lucky enough to belong within that mythology, that's an enormous privilege. That's something astonishing, no matter how many things were done wrong along the way. So in spite of all of that, here we are. I don't know what we are, 1,200 people or something. Sophisticated urban cappuccino drinkers. Yet, in spite of our urbanness, our belief that we are the people of the service economy, that we're post-industrial, that we're international in so many ways, unless we're talking about the Olympics or something like that, you know, that we're truly international. We belong to this concept of the postmodern individual who no longer has to work in a mine. And then you sort of pause for a second and realize that the Australian economy is probably more dependent on commodities than it's been since the Second World War. And somebody'd have to tell me the exact numbers. I looked quickly and couldn't see them. I certainly know that Canada is more dependent on commodities than it's been for about 50 years. So it's kind of odd. There are all these people living in these, you know, five, six big cities, as if there were no mines out there, as if there were no commodities out there, as if we were somehow part of this new society where our fingernails are nice and white and we don't get dirty. And we only have muscles because we go to the gym. Right? And yet, take away the commodities from Australia or Canada, and I can tell you what's left is little better than probably a mid-level third world economy. Because I know ours is about a third dependent on the commodities. Yours might even be more. Take away a third of your economy, you're not going to be sitting in this beautiful hall. Well, not listening to a speech. well, maybe listening to a radical local politician or a populist right-wing politician, one or the other, one of those extremes as in the 1930s. Anyway, so there is this contradiction between the way we're living our lives, which seems so European and Western, and the reality, which is that there's a whole other tradition here seen, evoked by those new Australians, and everybody in this hall, unless you're Indigenous or partly Indigenous, everybody in this hall at some point was one of those new Australians, just as I was one of those new Canadians. And my family's been in Canada for a couple of hundred years, but every generation we marry an immigrant to keep ourselves fresh and energetic. And we try to marry refugees because that's even more fresh and energetic, you know, and conscious and courageous, including me. I'm very lucky that way. So what's odd in all of this is that we haven't really come to terms with this contradiction between the dependence on commodities, the sophistication of the urban life, and the reality that there is this other philosophical and cultural basis to your civilization, which was totally destroyed in Europe. There were attempts made to destroy it here, we all know that, and in Canada. But the interesting thing is, it didn't succeed. We didn't succeed. It's there. Whatever the problems, it's there, it's strong, and it's alive. And that means you're really lucky, because you have, in a sense, access to thoughts and ideas, which are deeply outside of what's taught in business schools, just to take a small example. So what I guess I'm really saying is that I think that we've all bought into the Western concept of progress. I was reading this morning, I think it's a reasonably new Australian book by Michael Cathcart called The Water Dreamers. I don't know if any of you have read it. Very interesting. And he was quoting Philip, first governor, talking about the necessity of clearing away the woods, by which, of course, clearing away stuff that isn't under rational, linear, utilitarian control, right, in order to create imitations of Europe. And then he quotes James Tucker, a convict novelist, who I haven't read, but I'm quite curious to read now, not in the sake because it would be good, but in which Tucker says that the British race must, rescue the vast, untamed soils from the barbarism of nature. It's all there. Everything is there. Everything that's wrong is in that sentence. Everything that's wrong about your country and my country is there. Everything that's wrong with Europe is there. This sentence was written by Jean-Jacques Rousseau, right? If you go to a philosophy department at any university in Australia, what you'll hear is philosophy. This is the way philosophy works, right? What you'll hear is that there was Greece, and then there was Rome, and then there was Rome again, right? Because there's Rome without Christianity and Rome with Christianity. And then it sort of filters over to Germany and to France and to England. And then, by the goodness of their hearts, it makes its way here and to Canada and to other lowly places. And for hundreds of years, we learn this stuff because, of course, we're not capable of having thoughts of our own. We haven't had a single thought of our own in the hundreds of years that people have been here. Not a single original thought. All we can do are footnote Immanuel Kant and Jean-Jacques Rousseau. That's all we can do. PhD after PhD. You know, specialists in Kant, really. How interesting Jean-Jacques Rousseau is when thinking about the outback. You know, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, great expert, really one of the founders of the concept of nature and therefore of how we deal with the environment today, right? There are two or three people like that, and they're all romantics. You know, he has a nice lunch with his mistress in his lovely little, her little lovely little chateau in the mountains, and then goes for a walk through the park where all the trees are lined up, so he wasn't going to hit any of them. And you know, he's got a glass in his hand and perhaps a cigar, and you know, there are no bugs, no snakes, nothing. You know, nothing dangerous. Somebody behind him to pick up the glass when it's empty, and so on. That's nature. You know. And this is the philosophical basis upon which we are teaching philosophy, which would have any relationship to the environment in Australia or Canada or the United States or anywhere. And so are you just at all surprised that we're not doing too well in this area? Because what we're teaching has no relationship to the reality as we know it, particularly in countries like this. So we've really bought in not simply to the romantic idea of what nature is, something that must be broken, tamed, and then put up again like pieces in a game, in order to sort of hide from us what we may actually be doing in holes in the ground, or whatever, with commodities. So we bought into all of that. We bought into the classic Western idea of progress, you know, benefited very well. And we do have a lot of cappuccino and espresso machines. I mean, we have succeeded in a way, you know, in a way. And the growth has worked over a 200-year period. And yet, suddenly, here we are. We can see in the last 25, 30 years, this growing environmental crisis, global warming. And, you know, you do a simple thing. If you're a gambler, I don't know, Australians like to gamble a lot. I know my wife is part Australian, and so I've heard a lot about gambling in Australia. You're much better at it than the Canadians. I mean, although we do a lot of gambling, but we don't have much fun at it as you do. Everybody knows in gambling that if it's a 50-50 risk, then you have a pretty good chance of winning, but you also have a pretty good chance of losing, right? And so if somebody says to you, well, it's about 50-50 whether there's global warming or not, and they say, of course, if there is global warming and you don't act within the next 10 years, there's a 50-50 chance, another one, that, of course, your grandchildren will just die fried. Is that an acceptable risk? Right? Well, you know that's not an acceptable risk. Anybody who does the, you know, the tote or whatever it's called knows that's not an acceptable risk. You bet on global warming and therefore do something about it. And yet here we are, unable to do anything. What is it about this incredibly sophisticated civilization with more university graduates, more university places, more PhDs than there have ever been, even imaginable in history? Even 30 years ago wasn't imaginable. And yet, faced by a very simple proposition, a 50-50 chance that your grandchildren are going to fry, we can't act. All we can do is negotiate decimal points. In international meeting after international meeting, you can try and blame various, you know, economic sectors. But economic sectors only have that kind of power if the society has talked itself into impotence. And it's talked itself into impotence intellectually through its education system, through the sophistication of its elite. This is usually called degeneracy, by the way. You know, that's what that is. Degeneracy is highly sophisticated people who can't do anything. So if there's a 50-50 chance that your grandchildren are going to fry, that means and you don't do anything, that means you're degenerate. I mean, that's what they would say at Versailles in about 1750 anyway, and it turned out to be right there, so I think that's a pretty good example of the possibilities. So we can't move or act. We're sophisticated, silo-dwelling fools, backed into narrow parameters, locked inside these silos and these parameters, which prevent us from having what I would call integrated thought. And if you don't have integrated thought, you can't act. All you have is all sorts of bits and pieces of intelligence, lots of notes, lots of footnotes, no theory. And it prevents you from actually doing anything. In fact, it is a managerial dream in which nobody knows what's going on, and therefore each manager has a lot of power. It's just what's taught in most management schools, which is why they should be shut down. It's a nightmare for the rest of us, and probably a nightmare for the intelligent people or the imaginative people among the managers. So here we are, Australia, Canada, and some others, but I just picked the two that I really like and know, and I'm here and I come from the other place. Here we are in this very special position. We depend on raw materials. It's a great weakness. It's a great strength. It is a relationship to the land which has been sort of deformed in a way, and yet I don't want to be entirely negative about it either. And somehow we have not managed yet to seriously look at ourselves in light of non-linear, non-rational, non-Western philosophies, in spite of the fact that the reality of the life that we lead ought to force us to have a look at that and to listen to what is being said by very interesting people who come from here and come from Canada. And really, if you look at these ideas, which I've tried to and I've listened and so on, is that they're essentially non-linear ideas. They're essentially spatial ideas. I mean, you know all of this. And it's extremely interesting in the context of overproduction, of a crisis in globalism, which is a child of the rational linear movement, It's very interesting to think, to imagine, that there's a whole other philosophy here which doesn't belong to the tradition that produced that problem. That is a philosophy which is spatial, truly spatial. That's why, you know, the Europeans put on the Greek myths all the time, because they killed that in Europe. So they only have a kind of artificial link to the non-linear, to the spatial, by putting on things like the Greek plays and trying to imagine what it would be like to actually feel the spatial, as opposed to being the prisoner of the linear. I don't know if this makes any sense or not to you. To me, it makes a lot of sense. And it is such a privilege. I mean, I'm putting aside all the political stuff. It is such a privilege to be people of a country which has this kind of philosophy alive and well, because the people who are the source of that philosophy are alive and thinking that. Now, I know all the problems. I know all the politics and that sort of stuff. And I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about something which is at the very heart of the reality of the place. And yet we've always rejected listening to those ideas. We've been so desperate to be European, so desperate to be colonial, even when we're puffing ourselves up about being better than them. It's always better than them in the context of them, as opposed to being interesting, because different, because complex, because spatial, because non-linear, because not monolithic. That's much more interesting. In fact, I would say that we've reached the point where the rational approach, and those of you who have read Vulture's Bastards know I've been saying this for too long, that the rational has really, of course rationality has its role, but that it's reached a stage in Western democracies, style democracies, where it's out of balance, and it's in fact a negative balance. Witness incapacity to act when faced by a real crisis, your grandchildren frying, right? Incapacity to act. And in that sense, the modernity of the West, the modernity of the rational movement of the Enlightenment, of the Industrial Revolution, is so old-fashioned. It's so old hat. It's had its day. Of course, you can do things with it. You can improve it. You can amend it. There's great stuff in it. I love the paintings. I mean, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, it now seems to be so old-fashioned, so 19th century romantic, ideological, while pretending to be modern. And you look at things like Dreamtime, or you look at First Nations philosophies in Canada, like Wetaskiwin, which is a Cree philosophy about the people living in the land, with the land, or another West Coast Canadian indigenous Housit philosophy called Tsawwaq, which means all is one, which means that we are one with the place. And if you're one with the place, you can do something, you can act correctly within the place, as opposed to believing that the place is just a factory in the process of becoming. So in that sense, you could say that Dreamtime is actually postmodern, and that rationality is 19th and 18th century romantic. And that's, if you sort of think about that, it's kind of interesting. Even if you only believe half of what I'm saying, it's kind of interesting.
On Radio National's Big Ideas, I'm Alan Saunders, and you're listening to The Collapse of Globalism with John Ralston Saul. So, for Ralston Saul, if the modernity of the Enlightenment and of the Industrial Revolution is passé, what is the answer? Let's return now to the Sydney Town Hall and find out.
In 1999, I was in Sydney in a university hall, same number of people, again being recorded for television or radio, and I'd just seen the head of your Reserve Bank, who was a conservative, and I'd been thinking about not whether I was for or against globalism or globalization, but whether it was working or not, which is a separate issue. And he said, off the record more or less, you know, this financial system, all of us, except for a couple of us, I mean, the couple were basically in Washington and London, think that this is a disaster, this financial system, and it's going to fall down. It's just, it's inflationary, it's unstable, it's unmanageable, we don't know what's going on, and so on. And so it made me decide, it was sort of the last piece in a puzzle, and I thought to myself, yeah, this is what's happening, globalism is falling apart. Doesn't matter whether you're for or against. It's falling apart. It's coming to an end. And so that's what I said that night, with that kind of tickle in your stomach. And you think, gosh, I could be making a total fool of myself, and I will never rise again as a writer. I say this with a little hesitation, because every time I say this in private, people who know me well say, for God's sake, John, you know, don't say stuff like that. It's so, you know, self-serving. You know, it's like you're going up there and saying, I told you so. And of course, given Protestant modesty, one should never say, I told you so. But on the other hand, I know a lot of people who aren't Protestants, and so I don't see any harm in it. On the other hand, there's also the problem of the Catholic approach, which is, you know, you don't want to make people too aware of the guilt they ought to be feeling. And even if you reject both of the religious positions, why make enemies unnecessarily by being too smart in public? I mean, that would be an English argument, right? You don't want to be too smart by half or anything. I mean, there's a T.S. Eliot line that the humankind cannot bear very much reality. That kind of cynicism of that approach. Well, I think it's collapsed. I think it started collapsing after 1995. I've said that before. I think by 2000 we went into a post-globalist period, into a vacuum, as I think I've said. And I said that, you know, we had about 5 to 10 years to get it right, because otherwise events would take over, and the events would hit us so hard that we would then spend the next 25 years responding to the events. And that's... I told you so. You know, sorry. And that's where we are, deeply in debt in many cases. I mean, thanks to you, you know, the two of us got a lot of commodities, so we can kind of fudge our way out of it to a great extent. But it's not because we're smart. It's just because there's stuff in the ground. There's a difference, right? And people say, well, what do you mean by globalism? You know, are you talking about neoconservatives? No, not entirely. I mean, are you talking about Bush and Thatcherism? No, not entirely. Everybody bought into this theory. It really did become the ideology, the theory of a new era after the crisis of the 70s. It was the catchword. It was the new word for international. You couldn't say international anymore. You had to say globalization. And everything that was international was to be seen through the mechanisms of globalization, which is to say through an economic prism. So here we've had this large financial crisis. And I don't incidentally think that the financial crisis has caused the end of globalism. That had already happened some years before. It's a little bit like the 1970s when there was the oil crisis. But of course, it wasn't the oil crisis that caused the crisis that brought to an end Keynesianism. The oil crisis was just the thing that prompted the crisis that was coming anyway. And the financial crisis is just the thing, the easiest thing to prompt the larger crisis. And what you really need to do, what history tells you when there's a financial crisis, is you lance the boil. You lance the boil and you get the pus out. And history is full of examples. I wrote about it in Voltaire's Bastards. Going back to Greece, Sully in 1610 in France, you lance the boil, you get rid of the debt, and you move on with clarity in order to get new complexity. But if you hold up the unsustainable complexity of the debt, which cannot be dealt with, you basically are tying yourself down for decades and decades and preventing yourself from doing interesting things. And that misdiagnosis of the 70s led to globalism. Today, we're in very much a different mindset, but the same mindset. We want stability. And so we're busy protecting ideas which have failed. We cannot admit they failed. And so we have to do everything we can to keep them in place. Systems that have failed, we're spending hundreds of billions of dollars to keep them in place for fear that we'll upset ourselves by upsetting the leaders who failed. And we'll upset the professors of economics who failed. If we say it failed, what do we do about all those tenured professors of economics who control the economics departments in virtually everywhere in the world? I mean, 90-95% of the professors in economics departments around the world, particularly in the developed economies, believe exactly the same thing, you know, with a few differences. What do we do? I mean, we can't fire them. We can't re-educate them. We're not Mao Zedong. We can't send them out to a pig farm, even though in that case it might be an interesting idea. We don't have to have them die on the pig farms. We just could get them out of the universities and let them think about other ways of doing things. And then they could come back and see how they'd learned what they'd learned about reality. But here we are protecting this stuff. So, you know, it's as if we've forgotten in this process, this managerially driven process of certainty that the past is behind us and we're doing new things. And if it's failed, well, we're going to do more new things. We're never going to look at the past. And so we forget what people have said for thousands of years about money. You know, thousands of years. They've always said the same thing. I mean, Hume talked about it as the oil which greases the wheels. In other words, it's the thing that makes other stuff move. That's all it is. It's not a thing itself. It's a facilitator. It's not actually a commodity of its own. And so the crisis comes and everything starts falling. And since most bankers are men and don't cook, they misunderstood how you make a souffle, because, of course, really, money isn't real. Money is an imaginary, you know, object. It's imagined. You imagine it, and you imagine what's the right amount of money vis-a-vis what you want to do. You know, the oil. How much oil do you need to turn the wheels? How much oil do you need in the salad? And, you know, how many egg whites do you need? How much do you have to whip them to get the souffle to rise? And how big do you want the souffle to be? And the problem that one forgets is that if you believe that your economy is money, as the British in particular did, then, of course, at a certain point, if you don't eat the souffle, it falls. And once it starts falling, it just keeps falling. So we brilliantly, once it started falling, simply printed a lot more money and stuffed it into the souffle. Didn't even bother whipping it. Didn't even bother separating the yolk from the whites. Now, any woman would have told, maybe there were some women bankers who don't cook, I don't know, but it said because they're too busy being bankers, maybe they're an older generation of men who aren't part of that cooking generation of men, you know. They're just the wine-drinking generation of men. It's a good thing, too. So they stuffed all this stuff in and to keep the souffle up. And they haven't kept the souffle up. They just created this heavy, lard-like, impacted thing out there, which is basically debt and so on. Well, the real value of that money has evaporated, and you and I, the citizens, are left responsible for the debt incurred. It has not been brilliant. I mean, it hasn't been the stupidest thing ever done. But it hasn't been brilliant, because if you're going to do something like that, you had to figure out how to go through and come out the other side. And instead, we've gone in and left societies deeply, deeply indebted. You know, we went through 40 years of believing that public debt is bad, right? And all over the world, governments, Western governments, cut back on public programming to reduce debt. We broke countries in Africa and in Latin America to get rid of debt. Debt is evil, right? And then suddenly the people who said debt is evil are falling apart, and they get down on their knees and beg for the governments whom they don't believe in and which should not exist and should not interfere in the private sector. They get down on their knees and beg them to print money in order to prop them up. And so the governments, which are completely incompetent and incapable of doing this, according to these people, do it, prop them up, and then having propped them up, the people who are propped up say, well, I feel better now. Gosh, you people are awfully indebted. You better cut those public services. You know? And if you put any taxes on us, I mean, but we're Australian, I'm telling you, if you put taxes on us, we're going to Canada. You know. Of course, in Canada, I think they're... I've been away for 2 weeks, but I think in Canada they're saying they're going to Australia. So, you know, these are very old lines. They've been around forever. The threat of, we'll leave if you tax us. Well, really? You're going to take all that coal with you, are you? Interesting. Interesting. In your pockets? Good luck. So what is it that's slowing us up so much? Why are we incapable of acting? Well, I've given you some examples in a general sort of way. But I think that first it's because we've talked ourselves out through this silo approach of learning, talked ourselves out of really originality. I've actually reached the point, the latest book I've written, which is a Canadian book of political history, if you like, there isn't a single footnote in it. I'm becoming allergic to them because I feel they're so close to the problem, which is that everything is building blocks of truth. Of course, they're not truth. They're simply building blocks that have been decided upon arbitrarily. And if you believe that that's the only way forward, you end up discouraging thought. The thought that produced public health care, public education, or the thought that produced democracy in the 18th and 19th centuries, all of that would have been impossible if you had to think about it today, because it could be disproved by the footnote approach towards action. This is not interesting intellectually. This is profoundly uninteresting. So there are very few interesting ideas coming out. And one of the reasons, the other reasons there are so few interesting ideas coming out, is that when you have an ideology that's been in place for 30, 40 years, the leaders are tired. Forgive me, Minister. I wasn't talking about you. I'm sure. The leaders are tired. The reason they're tired is because they weren't there for the revolution, which was in the 70s. They're not the child of the revolutionaries. By now, you know, most people only stay in power as deputy ministers or heads of corporations or heads of universities. Only stay in power in the top positions for, 3 to 5 years, a couple of people for 8 to 9 years. Then they're gone to play golf or die or whatever they do. And, you know, and so you're now up to about the fourth generation of globalists in power. They have no memory of how they came to power. They have no memory of what a revolution of ideas looks like. They just believe it's always been that way, just the way the aristocrats in Versailles in 1780s thought it had always been that way, so it always would be that way. But, you know, time goes by, you get tired, you fail, and you're out. And new ideas come in. The difficulty is that our intellectual processes are shut down by this silo approach towards learning and argument, the sort of control of the specialist over broader arguments, preventing the broader arguments. In a way, the intellectuals have once again become central to the problem, because they can't find their way through the ideology that's in place. And I talk about this in A Collapse of Globalism. It's been reissued with the new concluding chapter where I say, I told you so. And after the crisis, explaining, finally that I can write the conclusion properly. And I made a comparison to the Catholic Church when it was in deep trouble and they created the Sacred Congregation of the Propagation of the Faith. And the purpose of the Sacred Congregation was that these were servants of the faith, and their well-being, their success, depended on their ability to assert that they were revealing the truth. And the structure of our intellectual class today is very similar to the Sacred Congregation for the Propagation of the Faith, particularly in the area of economics and management. So one, the vast majority of professors of economics, from an ethical and intellectual point of view, are in departments which were cleansed, sort of intellectually cleansed in the 70s and 80s, of alternate thoughts. So there's really no discussion going on in most of these economics departments. They're just agreeing with each other as the building comes down. And they're going on right now. I'm sure there are people, kids here, who are in economics. They're teaching you what they taught before the crisis, what they taught 20 years ago, because there is no crisis, because they're right. That's disastrous, and that's bad economics, because it has nothing to do with reality. It is the continuing victory of the delusion of microeconomics over economic history. In other words, of printouts over thought, of confusion of details, of numbers, over actually thinking about what's really happening. Secondly, the business schools, which are the suck-up-all-money mechanisms of modern universities throughout the world, are not places of thought. They themselves have to admit that they're places of utilitarian methodology. They're linear. They're about the inevitable. They're not the place where any new ideas are going to come. And then, of course, out of both of those departments, you have the consulting industry. I could say, how many of you are consultants? Raise your hands. There are lots of interesting people in the consulting industry. You can make money there. But that has nothing to do with thinking about changing the direction of the economy or of society, because you're paid, actually, for reassuring people and keeping things going. And then fourth, of course, out of there are the poorest people, and therefore the people most desperate to be right, which is, say, the economic journalists. The people least likely to say anything original, there are a couple of exceptions, and most desperate to be thought to be original because everybody agrees with them. Well, those of us who try to be original know that it isn't about being agreed with. You add up those four groups, and what you have is kind of medieval scholasticism at its worst. People obsessed with details without a sense of where they're going. People who've forgotten that they're just jotting down notes in the margins of the Bible, but they've forgotten what the Bible's about. And they can't even have an argument about the text. So, you know, in 1999 when I came here and I gave that speech, and after seeing the head of your Reserve Bank, I started saying that globalism was really like a rather rickety old bus which had been cobbled together with two 19th century ideas. It's interesting. This is a modern globalist revolutionary theory. Funny, when you analyze it, you find it's made up, its roots, its foundations, two foundations. English, free trade, middle of the 19th century, a left-of-center, pro-democratic, pro-social programming movement, and buccaneer capitalism of the late 19th century, an anti-democratic, right-wing, anti-public programming movement. So these brilliant theorists of the 60s and 70s glued the two enemies together and said, oh, look, a new theory. Now, anybody could have worked out that this wasn't going to last all that long, because it was contradictory. The free traders hadn't understood what the buccaneer capitalists were saying, and the buccaneer capitalists, who were actually managers, not buccaneer capitalists, hadn't understood what the free traders were saying, and neither of them had thought about whether anything had changed since the 19th century. So it worked for a while. It did some really good things, there's no question about that. It did some really bad things, there's no question about that. And by 1995, it had hit its high point and had gone into decline. And by 2000, 2001, if you wanted to, you could see the wheels were falling off the bus. The mirror was already knocked off, windows were breaking, and so on and so on. And I've written about what that all looked like. So in a way, the ideology remains in place, but what's actually happening is really the opposite of the ideology. So you're talking about free trade, whereas in fact Europe and the United States has been putting up barriers to China now for almost a decade, while talking free trade. You know, and that's just one small example. But it explains to you, this contradiction explains to you why people have come to accept doing totally contradictory things, like saying, I don't believe in government and I don't believe in public debt, but please indebt yourselves heavily to save us. And once you've indebted ourselves heavily, we're not going to pay you back and you have to cut your programs. That's logical, you know. And it just goes by. And there isn't much criticism in the papers because of what I said about the economic journalist. So what happened? Why is this happening? Well, in part because we keep talking about capitalism missing a few things. We say, well, it was about individualism, it's about competition, it's about technology, it's about trade. And we always forget that the essential element in capitalism since the 1780s has been scarcity. What makes competition work is there aren't enough products. If there aren't enough products, then companies can fight each other to sell them. And you can push the prices up because people need them. But the West, which includes you, in this model, has been in surplus in every single commodity and every single product for about 30, 40 years. I mean, there isn't a single thing in this audience of which there is not too much, unless you're wearing a piece of jewelry, which is one of a kind or something like that, or you've written a poem. Well, there are a lot of poems, but yours might be the poem, right? Otherwise, everything you're wearing, everything, all this technology, everything, there's too much. This hall, no, there's not too much of this. But there's too much of everything. We're in surplus. We succeeded. Of course, we haven't succeeded in distributing the surplus. That's a separate problem. But we're capable of producing much, much more than we need. What's more, a single city in China is capable of producing pretty well everything we need. Right. So once you're in surplus, then the whole theory of capitalism actually has to be radically changed. So we thought we could change this problem of having succeeded by producing a surplus of goods. We thought we could change it by opening ourselves to China and India, who, of course, have enormous markets ready to consume. What we missed, of course, was that they sell, they don't buy. They'd rather buy stuff produced by themselves. Does that make them protectionists? Oh my God. Isn't that something? Isn't that something that the people who are going to save globalization turn out to be nationalists? What are we going to do about that? Well, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to do what the United States and Europe's doing, which is we're going to put up barriers against them, which the Chinese know we're going to do. You're a bit of an exception for the moment. But essentially, what the world is doing, the surplus-laden world is doing, is putting up barriers because they find that they can't sell their goods, but there's a lot of stuff to buy. And it's not because it's produced cheaply that we're buying it. It's because once you go into surplus, the prices, the real prices, start going down, right? And once the real prices start going down, middle-class people can't produce them and make at a wage which makes enough for them to live. So automatically, you start looking for sources which aren't middle class. And say, oh, those goods are really cheap. Isn't that great? But the reason you're doing it is because you can't sustain a real price once you're in surplus. The surplus pushes the price down, justifying the lower wages, the job instability, the need to go to places where the wages are cheaper. And the other way you deal with being in a surplus is the other thing that we're doing more and more of, which is you make the stuff disappear. Most people think that about half of what we produce now is simply made to disappear. It isn't sold at all. I mean, it's compacted, it's buried, it's burnt, it's, you know, we send it to various places around the whole world for lesser and lesser cost, just hoping it'll go away, because there is no market, actually, for those T-shirts or those computers or whatever it is. So the real question isn't whether, you know, you're in favor of more trade, whether you're against free trade. All of that is really beside the point now. It's misreading the situation. The need is not now for more trade, more particularly for less trade. It's the need is really now to rethink the way in which we produce and what we produce, to rethink how we do economics, to think about what inclusive economics would look like, what spatial economics would look like. There are people working on that. So the time has come for us to say, oh, right, how do we deal with this surplus? How do we deal with the social and environmental problems that come out of having succeeded, in a sense, with our linear idea of progress? How do we, in a sense, rebuild Europe in a new way, you know, as they did after 1945, not in the old way? Well, obviously, one of the things we have to do is shrink the financial sector. We don't need to be at 80 times or 50 times. I mean, this is basically, and all the good bankers agree about this off the record, you know, we don't need that amount of paper or imaginary paper floating around. It just creates an illusion of action and a form of inflation, which isn't being counted. It doesn't create real profit. It isn't real wealth creation. Maybe we should be looking at the old systems of co-op banking and so on, and seeing if that wouldn't be an alternate way of thinking about how to manage money. We have to be looking at value-added production. That really, raw commodities is less and less interesting as a way to make money for a civilization. If we're the best educated population that's ever existed, it makes sense that we should be producing the most sophisticated goods as opposed to more and more cheap goods that aren't particularly interesting. Why aren't we able to do that? Well, because we're still stuck in so many old 19th century modes. And one which I just can't resist repeating is, you know, the most revolutionary breakthrough in the 20th century was that in 1900, according to the insurance industries of the world, life expectancy on average was 50. And that includes all the things about childbirth and death and women dying in childbirth. It was 50. And we virtually doubled life expectancy in 100 years. That is the single most important breakthrough of the 20th century. And yet here we are. Smart people still running our societies on models of life, education, work, family, retirement, models put in place by the Taylorists and so on in the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, as if we were going to die at 50. We have not done what needs to be done every 100 years or so, what they did in 1780 to 1820 and 1880 to 1910, 20. We have not sat back and said, okay, well, that was quite an interesting century. We did some really stupid things. We did some smart things. What do we do for the next 100 years? We're afraid to do that because we have an elite that's so convinced that stability means being right all the time and not moving and not changing things. We're unable to have that examination. And the result is that we're still stuck in this old 19th century male linear system. So let me leave you as if I was starting a whole new speech. The European Westphalian model of the nation state, which you believe you are the scion of, as do most Canadians. The model is entirely based on the concept of the oneness of the nation state. Everybody is basically the same. The monolithic nation state. That's why they killed all those people, so that they could pretend they were one. Right? You're not. Complexity, racial, linguistic, religious, enormous complexity, non-monolithic. Second, the European Western nation state, obsessed by race, obsessed by oneness. What was here, as with what was in Canada, was much more about community and place. And increasingly, those citizens, those new Australians I was talking about, wanting to belong in a manner of community, putting aside the question of race and replacing it with the idea of community, which is very close to the indigenous idea of belonging and of community and of place. It's an interesting meeting, and it cuts out the English and the French and the German and, frankly, the US way of thinking about the United States. It's a celebration of complexity versus the obsession with getting it so that every school kid will stand up at the same hour and sing the same song or memorize the same poem, which was the obsession of the Europeans. The Westphalian nation state, and here's a little linguistic thing which is kind of fun, or not. The Westphalian European nation state always talks about the migrants. Migration. Now, what does the word migration mean? I'll tell you what it means. They're here and we hope they're leaving. That's what it means. Migrating. No stopping point. Not for too long. Really, when you dig a little bit here, you'll find what you're talking about is immigrants. Immigrants who become citizens. Right? It's completely different. It's not migrants. It's not European. It's immigration. And you really, the way to think about it is that an immigrant is like somebody who gets engaged to the country and to you, if you're already a citizen, and then they get married to the country. And of course, like marriage, it's filled with differences and complexities. And but the interesting thing is that there are a lot fewer divorces in citizenship than there are in families. So it's an interesting kind of marriage, but it's not at all this idea, well, they're here because of the jobs. It's actually they're here to belong, but to belong in new and interesting ways. And that, again, goes back to the indigenous in your society. The Westphalian, endless wars to have one religion. Well, you know perfectly well this country was not built on one religion, built on the idea of multiple religions. One myth. You know that even there were attempts to make Australia a place of one myth, that actually what's made Australia more and more interesting, like Canada more and more interesting, is that it's becoming more and more complicated, and complexity's fun. Complexity's good. I always say about Canada that, you know, there's this disease, multiple personality disorder. We're a multiple personality order. And the reason I feel so comfortable in Australia, is I think you're also a multiple personality order. It's a great strength, which you should be very, very proud of. The Westphalian nation state is all about the rational linear, and I think you are increasingly about the spatial, the dream time. And I think you're increasingly comfortable with it, even when you don't realize you're comfortable with it. So I think these ideas of here, whatever the problems, I know the problems, they're alive and they're strong. They represent an enormous opportunity for you vis-a-vis this place, but also for you in terms of action and in terms of leadership on the international scene. Thank you very much.
A celebration of complexity. That was John Ralston Saul speaking on the collapse of globalism at the Sydney Town Hall as part of the Sydney Writers' Festival. And if you'd like to hear this program again, download it or leave a message, you can do so by going to our website, abc.net.au/rn/bigideas. Thank you for joining me today on Big Ideas. I'm Alan Saunders, and you can catch me again tomorrow afternoon on the Philosopher's Zone or next weekend on By Design. On ABC Radio National, bye for now.
After 1 year, I was sent to the front. I was given an AK-47 and a cyanide capsule.
On 360 Documentaries, we continue with tales from the 30-year war in Sri Lanka.
We kept walking and came closer to the border. The Sinhalese troops started to shoot at the Tamil Tigers. They shot back and we were caught in the middle. It was complete chaos.
A year after the war ended, the task of making peace and rebuilding is enormous.
Yeah, more than 70%.
There are 100,000 people in the camps, and over 70% have mental problems.
That's the concluding part of the Five Fingers of Sri Lanka.
Most of the patients have post-traumatic stress syndrome. They have bad memories from the war. We give them shock treatment and drugs.
360 documentaries. Have a listen at the ABC Radio National website.